Good evening, everyone, and it is a great pleasure to see so many of you here. Maybe one day monetary policy will be sufficiently boring that you won't want to turn up, but I suspect not. Thank you very much, Richard, for your introductory comments. It's a great pleasure for me to be able to be here tonight speaking at CEDA's annual dinner. It's become a tradition at these dinners for the Governor of the RBA to talk about how we secure Australia's continued economic prosperity. And tonight I would like to continue that tradition. My focus is going to be on the importance of trust as an essential building block in economic prosperity. This focus is a bit different from the normal turf of economists, things like productivity, investment, and capital accumulation. Of course, we do need to keep a close eye on those things. But in doing so, we should not lose sight of the fact that our economy, and indeed our society, works best when there are high levels of trust. And those in whom trust has been placed need to do their very best to be worthy of that trust. There's an element of trust in all economic transactions. Without it, commerce simply can't flourish. But the nature of trust in our society is changing. And unfortunately, we can all think of recent examples where trust in our institutions and organisations has been severely tarnished. And at the same time, changes in technology mean that we're increasingly trusting in the wisdom of the crowd on our preferred online platform rather than on traditional institutions. As some have argued, trust is now more likely to be distributed rather than to flow vertically from trusted institutions. This is a very significant change. But regardless of how trust is earned and retained in our modern economy, we all have a very strong interest in living in a high-trust society. And I'd like to use this theme of trust to talk about three broad issues this evening. The first is the role of trust in finance. The second is the importance of the community having trust that living standards will improve over time. And the third is trust in institutions. Here, naturally enough, I'll focus on the central bank and the importance of accountability and transparency. In this context, I'll end up with a few words about current monetary policy. As you all know, finance is mainly about trust. When a deposit is placed in a bank, we trust it's going to be repaid. We also trust financial institutions to invest our hard-earned savings for us, and we trust them to provide us with financial advice that's in our best interest. Without that trust, the financial system cannot operate properly and the economy cannot prosper. As the first line of the Banking and Finance Oath says, trust is the foundation of my profession. And I encourage everybody here in the finance sector to read that oath regularly and to more than read it, to actually live by the principles in that oath. Australia's banks have a very strong record of being worthy of the trust that's placed in them to repay deposits. The last bank failure in Australia that resulted in a loss to depositors was almost 90 years ago, back in 1931. And on that occasion, it was a very small bank and depositors lost only a fraction of their deposits. This is a positive record that's shared by very few other countries. And this strength was again apparent during the financial crisis a decade ago, and it served Australia very well. The Australian banks are strongly capitalised and they have considerable liquidity. And on the whole, they've also managed credit risk effectively, reporting few problem loans by international standards. This means that we can have a high level of trust in the ability of Australia's banks to repay depositors. Indeed, our strong and stable banking system is one of the Australian economy's great strengths. It's in other areas, though, where trust has been strained. It's clear that the behaviours highlighted by the Royal Commission have dented the community's trust in parts of the financial sector. The case studies used by the Commission have put the spotlight on three very important issues. The first of these is the inadequate way in which banks have dealt with conflict of interest issues. The second is the way that poorly designed incentive systems can distort behaviour, promoting a sales culture at the expense of a service culture and promoting the short term at the expense of the long term. And the third issue is the fact that the consequences of not doing the right thing have, in some cases, been too light. Strengthening trust in our financial institutions requires all three of these issues to be addressed. Central to this task is creating a strong culture of service within Australia's financial institutions. Too often, our financial institutions prioritised sales over service. And correcting this starts with the system of internal reward established by the board and by the management. The vast bulk of people who work for Australia's financial institutions do want to do the right thing, and they do want to serve their customers as best they can. But like everyone else, they respond to the incentives that they face. If they're rewarded on sales or short-term objectives, it shouldn't come as a great surprise to us that that's what they prioritise. So establishing the right incentives here is key. One of the things that influences incentives is the consequences and penalties that apply when something goes wrong. Strong penalties can play an important role in incentivising good behaviour, and this is an area that we should be looking at. But we do need to get the balance right here, as it can have unintended consequences. In my view, it's worth making a distinction between the penalties that apply for poor conduct and those that apply for making loans that ultimately cannot be repaid. On conduct issues, we should set our expectations and standards high, and if they're not met, the penalties should be firm. On lending, though, matters are more complex. Even when banks lend responsibly, a percentage of borrowers will end up in financial strife and be unable to meet their obligations. So we need banks to be prepared to make loans in the full expectation that some borrowers will not be able to pay those loans back. After all, banks need to take risk and they need to manage that risk well. If they do become afraid to lend, simply because of the consequences of making a loan that goes bad, then our economy will suffer. So this is an area we need to watch very carefully, and an appropriate balance does need to be struck. More broadly, having clear lines of accountability can help build trust. The Banking Executive Accountability Regime, the so-called BEAR regime, is helpful here. This regime, though, is largely limited to authorised deposit-taking institutions and to prudential matters. It is worth thinking about how the same focus on accountability can be applied to a broader range of financial services and to conduct issues as well. As we do this, though, we should not lose sight of the fact that it is banks, boards and management that are ultimately responsible for the decisions that the banks make. It's unrealistic, I think, to expect that an appropriate culture can be created through regulation and through penalties. Creating the right culture is the core responsibility of the boards and the management of our banks. Changes that are now taking place within the financial sector should, over time, help restore trust. I think it's going to be a slow and gradual process, though. The Royal Commission will have some recommendations that will hopefully assist with the process as well. One thing that would help is for financial institutions to have a long-term focus and reflect that in their internal incentives. Managing to short-term targets might boost the share price for a while, but this short-termism can weaken the long-term franchise value of the bank. I think we've seen some examples of this recently. I would argue that the franchise value is more likely to be maximised if our financial institutions have a long-term perspective, if they treat their customers well, if they reward loyalty rather than take advantage of it, and if they invest in systems and technology that deliver world-class financial services for Australians. In my view, doing this would not only be good for bank shareholders, but it would also be good for the broader community. I'd now like to turn to the second issue, and that's a slightly different concept of trust, but in my view, it's one that's no less important. And that is the community's trust that real living standards will improve over time. On many accounts, the Australian economy has performed very well over recent times. Over the past year, it's grown by close to 3.5%. Inflation's been low and stable at around 2%. Employment has grown quite strongly, and we're getting quite close to full employment. I think you can see the general picture in this first chart here, if I can. I don't know whether someone, yeah, there we are, thank you. So overall, it's a very positive picture. Business conditions are positive, and government finances have also improved in reasonable shape. There's a lot of investment taking place in the economy, particularly in infrastructure, and the number of job vacancies is at a record high. The unemployment rate in New South Wales and Victoria is back to where it was in the early 1970s, so more than almost 50 years ago. So overall, it's quite a positive picture. Yet despite how often this story is told, not everybody shares this positive assessment. As Paul said, not everybody feels connected to the progress that I see from a macro point of view. This next graph helps explain why this is the case. It shows how average hourly earnings in Australia adjusted for inflation have changed over time. I think the picture's pretty clear. Over the period from 1995 to 2012, we witnessed a substantial lift in real hourly earnings. On average, real wages increased by almost 2% a year, and that resulted in a substantial increase in people's real living standards. This occurred alongside inflation averaging around the midpoint of the 2 to 3% range and with strong growth in corporate profits. Since 2012, though, it's been a different story. Over these 6 years, there's been very little change in average real hourly earnings. The increases in wages that we've seen have been broadly matched by inflation. This is quite a change, and it's having significant effects. On the positive side, flat real wages have supported the substantial gains in employment that we've seen, so they've benefited many people. At the same time, though, flat real wages are diminishing our sense of shared prosperity. The lack of real wage growth is one of the reasons why some in our community question whether they're benefiting from Australia's economic success. This is not a uniquely Australian story, though. A similar thing has happened in many advanced economies around the world. And as a result, too many citizens around the world have diminished trust in the idea that the policies that have underpinned growth over the past 30 years are working for them. They feel more uncertain about the future, and in some countries are also having to deal with very high housing prices. This unease is occurring despite the fact that unemployment rates in many advanced economies being the lowest they've been in many decades. The diminished trust in the idea that living standards will continue to improve is a major economic, social and political issue. Arguably, it's the most important issue we face. It underlies some of the political changes that we're seeing around the world. It's also making it harder to implement needed economic reforms. It's in our collective interest that this trust be restored. This is a challenging task for us, but it's not an impossible one. Part of the solution is for the labour market to tighten further and for this to lead to a pickup in household income growth. The current setting of monetary policy is encouraging exactly this, and it's working. As the labour market has tightened in Australia over the past year, there has been a modest lift in wages growth, and we received further confirmation of this last week with the publication of the Wage Price Index. The RBA also continues to hear reports of larger wage rises in areas where there's strong demand for labour and workers are in short supply, and I expect that we'll hear more such reports over time. So this monetary policy strategy that we have of keeping interest rates low and tightening up the labour market, I think it's gradually working. From a longer term perspective, another part of the solution is to boost productivity. The factors that are contributing to flat real wages for many workers are complex, but many of them are linked to globalisation and to technology. And the best way of dealing with this is not to ignore these forces, but to do what we can to capitalise on them. This means government and business having a sharp focus on the question of how we can best flourish in a world of global markets and continuing improvements in technology. An important part of the answer must be investment in education, in education and skills development, and in research and development. I think we need to be thinking long term here. Realistically, more investment in human capital will not make much of a difference to real wages this year or next. But over the next decade or two, it's crucial to raising real wages and living standards. Increasingly, our prosperity rests on the ideas that we have, on how we can take advantage of those ideas and how we capitalise on new technologies. This means having a very strong culture of innovation in business. It's very important. With the right investments, I'm confident that Australians can enjoy high and rising real wages in a highly competitive and technically sophisticated world. There are, of course, other elements to lifting productivity. These would include the design of our tax system, the quality and pricing of our infrastructure, and the strength of competition in our markets. We need to keep these areas all in focus. The key point here, though, is that raising productivity and ensuring a strong economy will, over time, help deal with the diminished trust that people have in the idea that their real living standards will improve. As I said before, we all have a strong interest in that trust being restored. Without it, a lot of things become more difficult, not just on the economic front, but the social front as well. I'd now like to turn to the third aspect of trust, and that is trust in public institutions. One of Australia's strengths is that we have strong and stable public institutions. We can sometimes take this for granted, but strong public institutions are one of the foundations upon which our economic prosperity is built. They help support the public's trust in the development and implementation of economic policy and in the fair and effective administration of laws and regulations. And they can also help society balance some of the difficult trade-offs that we sometimes face. I hope that you see the Reserve Bank of Australia as one of those institutions. We have been entrusted with important responsibilities by the Australian Parliament. These include determining Australia's monetary policy, issuing Australia's currency, operating the core of Australia's payment system, acting as banker for the Australian government, and having broad responsibilities for financial stability and for competition, efficiency and stability in Australia's payment system. It's a long and important list. As we carry out these important responsibilities, I'm very conscious that as a central banker, I'm an unelected official acting on the public's behalf. Reflecting this, the first of our internal values that we use at the RBA is to act in the public interest. We work hard to be worthy of the trust that's been placed in us. We seek to do this by speaking and acting independently, consistent with our mandate, by being analytical and pragmatic in our approach to policy, and by being accountable and transparent. One element of transparency is the release of minutes after each of our monthly board meetings. The latest minutes were released this morning. These contain our assessment that the Australian economy has been doing well recently. It's growing a bit faster than average, the unemployment rate is trending lower, and inflation is low and stable. And we expect this to continue for a while yet. This is evident in this next chart, hopefully, which shows our updated forecasts. Growth this year and next is expected to exceed 3% before tapering off in 2020 as the boost from the large increase in LNG exports tapers off. Inflation is also expected to pick up, but only to pick up gradually, and inflation is expected to remain low, as you can see. The graph also shows the range of uncertainty based on historical experiences. The public focus is normally on the central scenario, but it's important to recall that the range of possibilities around that central scenario is quite large. As the minutes discuss, one of the current sources of uncertainty is the pace of growth in consumer spending. Over the past couple of years, consumer spending has been growing reasonably firmly and faster than disposable incomes. Our central scenario is for household spending to continue growing at around its current rate and for income growth to pick up to be in line with spending growth. But there are conflicting forces at work here. On the positive side, the strong employment growth that we've been witnessing is a plus for income and consumption growth. But working in the other direction are flat real wages at a time when debt levels are high and housing prices are falling in our largest cities. So we're continuing to assess the balance of these forces carefully. As we do this, we're watching the housing market closely. There has recently been considerable public attention to declining house prices in Sydney and in Melbourne. It's important, though, to remember that these declines come after very large run-ups in housing prices in these two cities, which made purchasing a home difficult for a significant number of people. You can see the large gains in housing prices over previous years in this next chart. There we are. Over the previous decade, housing prices in Sydney increased by almost 100%. So we had a very large run-up in prices and there's been a modest retracement of those gains. It's also worth pointing out that this adjustment is taking place against a backdrop of a strong world economy, a positive Australian economy, low and declining unemployment, low interest rates, strong population growth, and only limited pockets of excess supply in the housing market. And this is a reasonably favourable backdrop against which to be having an adjustment in our housing market, but we do need to watch things closely. The minutes also report that the board evaluated the forecast made by the bank this time last year. And the board does this type of evaluation exercise each year. Over the past 12 months, the economy has performed more strongly than we expected a year ago, and the unemployment rate has come down by more than was expected. At the same time, though, the stronger growth and the stronger labour market did not translate into more inflation. Wage growth and inflation turned out to be pretty close to what we thought they were going to be a year ago. The fact that growth was stronger than expected is largely accounted for by a positive surprise on investment. The terms of trade have also been stronger than we thought, which combined with a lower exchange rate has helped. The positive story for non-mining investment can be seen in this next graph, which shows the bank's successive forecasts over the years for non-mining investment, as well as the actual outcomes shown in the black line. So I think you can see for a number of years, we were forecasting a lift in investment that did not materialise. During this period of flat business investment, Glenn Stevens gave frequent speeches bemoaning the lack of animal spirits in the business community. But over the past couple of years, things finally turned around. The long forecast pickup in investment finally arrived, and it's been stronger than we expected over the past couple of years, and we expect this upswing in investment to continue for a while yet, so that's positive news. In the context of its forecast evaluation, the board also reviewed the various arguments that have been made by commentators for alternative courses of monetary policy. The timing of this review has no particular policy significance. It's simply good practice for us to consider the issues and arguments from all angles, and we do this as part of our regular evaluation exercise. As you know, following its deliberations a few weeks ago, the board again decided to maintain the cash rate at 1.5%, where it's been since August 2016. The central messages also remain the same. First, the economy is moving in the right direction, and further progress is expected in lowering unemployment and having inflation consistent with the target. The second message is the probability of an increase in interest rates is higher than the probability of a decrease. If the economy continues to move along the expected path, then at some point it will be appropriate to raise interest rates. This will be in the context of an improving economy and stronger growth in household incomes. The third and final point is that the board does not see a strong case for a near-term change in interest rates. There is a reasonable probability that the current setting of monetary policy will be maintained for a while yet. This reflects the fact that the expected progress on our goals of reducing unemployment and having inflation consistent with the target is likely to be only gradual. The board's view is that it is appropriate to maintain the current setting of monetary policy while we make this progress. Thank you very much for listening, and I look forward to your questions in a little while. Thank you.
Thank you again. The Governor has agreed to stay and take some questions. We're very fortunate to have that opportunity. A few housekeeping rules. When asking a question, please raise your hand. A microphone will be brought to you. Please tell us your name and organisation. And if I could ask people to refrain from making long comments, just a brief question, so that we give everybody an opportunity to ask a question. Of course, that rule about not making long comments doesn't apply to me. Anyway, if I can just start with a few things. I should also mention we have questions from the live stream that we're coming through on the iPad. I'll also be reading off some of those. So, Governor, if I can just start with an opener. Thank you again for your thoughts on those issues, and you talked a lot about trust. One of the things you talked about was the importance of productivity gains and innovation in business. That's a really interesting debate to have in a concept where we want to talk about wage growth, we want to talk about full employment and innovation in business, which can so often be confused for job losses in the individual sense. In a global sense, people can see the benefits of it, but individually it can impact people. So I just wonder whether you have an observation on that whole question of innovation and how we actually have that conversation or debate with the wider community about the benefits.
Well, if you think about kind of where the growth in the Australian economy is going to come over the next 20 years, it's going to come from businesses finding better way of doing things. You know, we've become an incredibly prosperous country largely because of what's on our land and what's under the land. And that's been the source of our comparative advantage for many, many years. If you think kind of, by the time my kids are my age, the comparative, if we're going to enjoy really high living standards, because what's in our brains? So we've got to find a way of kind of developing ideas and commercialising them in a way that we have not done. I think our future success depends on us doing that. How best business does it, I don't know. I think the innovation that's occurring, though, is causing kind of uncertainty, as you say, in parts of the workforce, because there's a lot of job churn going on. It's interesting because the unemployment rates, as I said in my remarks, around the world are the lowest they've been in decades, 30, 40, 50 years in some countries. Yet people don't feel happy, and I think it's because they see this innovation, they see a lot of change because of technology, and they're worried about the future. So I'm not sure what the solution there is, but we've got to find a way of keeping the ideas generation and innovation going and giving people confidence that that can coexist with improving living standards. And this is why I'm so focused on wages, because that's the way that these things can connect. And
I might just switch gears for a moment and just talk about the importance of resilience in the economy more broadly. We're 10 years on from the collapse of Lehman Brothers. I think the Australian Treasury Secretary noted just on the weekend that excessive leverage fundamentally sits behind most major crises. And I just wondered whether you have any observations about how you think the Australian economy, and perhaps more broadly the international economy, is placed in the should there be another shock event such as there was 10 years ago?
Yep. If you get hit by a shock, the one thing you want to have is the buffers against that shock. So you can think of buffers coming in a number of dimensions. Buffers in the financial sector, and they're stronger than they have been any time for a long time. So the amount of capital and liquidity that the banking system has globally is much better. So that's a positive development and gives us some extra degree of resilience. Another buffer you can have is on the fiscal front. And here the story is not good at all. In Australia, it's reasonable. It's probable that we'll get back to a budget surplus this year or next or the one after. So, and the level of public debt is low. So if we got hit by another shock, the Australian government still could use its balance sheet to stimulate the economy. In many other countries, that's not the case. You know, the US is a very good example at the moment. Public debt's extraordinarily high and the budget deficits have increased, and they're going to have budget deficits of 5% of GDP for as far as you can see. So the buffers in public sector balance sheets around the world are much, much reduced, which I think is a major concern. It's almost like the idea of building, you know, paying an insurance premium in the good times has become unfashionable. We assume the bad times won't return and we don't need to pay the insurance. Fortunately, that hasn't been the case in Australia. The third set of buffers are really in private sector balance sheets. A downturn, if you can borrow more, then you can smooth your consumption or firms can keep on investing. Corporate debt in many countries has increased a lot, so there's less ability there, and household debt levels, including Australia, are much higher. So there's less resilience in private sector balance sheets and in government balance sheets, but there's more resilience in financial sector balance sheets, so it's a kind of a mixed picture. But we need to build buffers in the system. That's the best thing. We need to pay insurance premiums in good times. And actually, it's good times now. Growth of 3.5%, unemployment of 5%, inflation low and stable at 2%. This is the time we should be building buffers in the system. We are kind of doing that in Australia, but not everywhere else in the world.
Speaking of the rest of the world, I know as part of your role, you spend a lot of time talking with your counterparts, the governors of the other banks. I wonder if you can share with us a little bit about what is on their mind in terms of the issues that are concerning them.
There are a few. One would be the escalation of the trade tensions between the United States and China. I think what we're seeing to date is it's highly regrettable, but it's manageable. The higher tariffs will lead to slower growth in China and in the US and in the rest of Asia, and we're starting to see some of the ripple effects of that now. But it's possible that those tensions escalate. I understand at the moment the Chinese are unhappy about the US tariffs. That's, you know, you can understand why they are. But the Americans also have some grievances, and they centre around the protection of intellectual property rights in China, very large state subsidies, and state-owned enterprises buying assets elsewhere around the world. So the Americans have some legitimate concerns. How those concerns ultimately get resolved, it's a really big issue, and we all have a very strong interest in those concerns being resolved in a constructive way, but there is a big question mark over whether that will happen. So that's one set of issues. Another over recent times, although it's a bit less now, is why wages aren't growing. This is one of the issues we talk a lot about in our meetings in Basel. In the US, the unemployment rate's down to where it was in 1969, and it's only just recently that wages have picked up. So why that's the case, why wages haven't been growing, and what's going to change, and is it possible that we get to a point where wages start rising very quickly just because they haven't risen for a long period of time, the labour markets are very tight, and what the implications of that would be. So they're the broad issues we've been grappling with.
I don't want this to sound like a cultural cringe question, but when you're at those meetings, what is the view back from those governors about the Australian economy?
Well, it's always been a very positive one. The standard question that I get asked at these meetings is, can you tell me why Australia has done so well for so long? What are the keys?
A good reserve bank? Is that your answer?
So, I mean, there are a lot of reasons I give, including strong public institutions, including the central bank, strong population growth, our links with Asia, a proud history of economic reform. So there are a lot of positives for me to talk about at those meetings. I only hope in 5 years' time I've got the same story to tell.
You mentioned strong population growth. The migration debate is on the agenda. Well, it's probably never really been off the agenda, and I just wonder whether you have a comment about that and the possibility of a slowing in that migration growth and the broader impact that may have on productivity.
Well, I don't think it's going to have very much impact on productivity in the short run, but the strong population growth has been an important driver of Australia's economic growth. The population at the moment is rising a bit faster than 1.5%, and that's one reason over a long period of time we haven't had a technical recession, because each year more and more people are living in this country and that's driving growth. So I think that's been an important factor. I also think it's had a positive spin-off in the fact that it's made our society, our country, much more diverse. In the most recent census, 50% of the population either had one parent born overseas or born overseas themselves. So there's no other Western country that can claim to kind of have such a large share of the population with foreign ancestry. And people come here, by and large, they're industrious, they're trying to make a better life for themselves and their family, and they often have business links back to it. So that's been an incredible positive for the Australian economy. As I gave a speech earlier this year, it's changed our demographics as well. We used to be in terms of kind of aging, we were aging pretty much like the rest of the world, and we were going to become an old society fairly quickly. That's changed around. So we are now one of the youngest Western countries, and we're going to stay young for quite a while, because we've had a lot of people come in their 20s, live in Australia, work, become part of productive members of the society. So that's very positive. I think that the negative is the pressure on infrastructure. And this has been a problem for many, many years. We have not invested enough in infrastructure to deal with the rising population, and it's causing many in the community to be unhappy and often to blame immigration, when the underlying problem is underinvestment in infrastructure, which we're now finally addressing. Whether we're going to do it quickly enough, I don't know, but it's... The economy can certainly cope with a cut in the current rate of immigration, and that may help deal with infrastructure problems, but the underlying point is that immigration has been very good for this country.
I will keep asking questions, but if you do have a question, please feel free to put up your hand and someone will come around. I think there might be one out there. In fact, why don't we take that one now?
Governor, Paul Hislop from Asa Allen Consulting. You stressed the issue of trust and the importance of trust in institutions for the stability of the financial system. Wouldn't it be fair to say that's a more centrally planned sort of view of the world? And wouldn't it be better to focus more on trying to encourage more scepticism amongst people of people's behaviour? And wouldn't that also be consistent with improving educational standards?
I wouldn't agree with the idea that trust is a kind of a centrally planned concept. And trust is is central to every transaction between two people, whether it's a kind of a business transaction or a personal transaction. And my perspective is that a lack of trust diminishes the productivity of the economy and the constructive nature of transactions between people and businesses. So I think it's incredibly important concept in a market-based economy. It's important in finance, it's important in general business, and it's important in the political sphere. I think there's enough scepticism out there. We need to, trust shouldn't be given blindly, it needs to be earned. As I said in my remarks, all those in whom trust has been placed need to do everything they can to be worthy of that trust. Businesses need to be, public officials need to be, financial institutions need to be.
Thank you very much for your speech, Governor. This is not an economic speech. I'm Liz Cohen from CARA, a disability organisation, but one of leadership. You spoke about trust in your speech, and I'm aware you have built a strong culture of trust, loyalty and respect within the Reserve Bank. Can you share how you embedded this culture?
Well, for an organisation like the Reserve Bank, I'd say it's relatively easy, because our mandate is low inflation, full employment and the welfare of the Australian people. So the essence of our organisation is serving the public interest. So we talk about that a lot internally. We're not driven by profit. We don't have short-term remuneration incentives. We're driven by serving the public interest. So we talk a lot about that internally. As I said, it's our first core internal value, and we keep repeating these ideas over and over. We're here to serve the public. We're here to promote the welfare of the 25 million people we serve. And I think that messaging kind of gradually gets through and comes part of the culture, and people feel that's what they're here to do in my organisation. We're here to serve the public. And so that consistent messaging, I think, is really important. And in private financial institutions, there's obviously different messaging, but I think service needs to be part of the messaging going forward. You know, we're here to service our customers, because the financial sector is kind of incredibly important for the economy. And it's all about service. And that needs to be the constant messaging in financial institutions. We're here to serve the people that trust us.
Picking up on the Royal Commission, you talked about needing to change the way that some of the conduct has been found in the Royal Commission, but you also mentioned you were very concerned about the impact of the Royal Commission on the stability of the banking system. Are you confident that we can get that balance right, addressing the instances of poor behaviour, but also protecting the stability of the banking system?
Yeah. Well, I'm confident that in the end we'll get to a better place on conduct. You know, there were too many examples that the Royal Commission has highlighted where the conduct was not up to scratch and the penalties weren't strong enough, and we'll fix that. Who knows what the nature of that fix is, but I'm confident we'll get through that. My current concern more is about credit supply. Now, a few years ago, credit standards were way too loose, and there's been a correction of that, but I'm starting to be a bit concerned the pendulum might be swinging a bit too far the other way. We need financial institutions to take risk, and that means lending to some people who actually can't pay the money back. Some share of the borrowers will not be able to pay back. But if banks become very scared to make loans to people who may not, under some circumstances, be able to pay the loan back, credit supply in the economy will diminish, and that will hurt the economy. So the pendulum has swung from credit supply being too generous, perhaps to credit supply being a bit tight, and I'm hoping in time it will come back to more centre. So we're watching the kind of the ability of financial institutions to provide credit very carefully.
Do you think in that debate and in that striving to get that balance right, there is an important role for the capital markets? I mean, there is a debate about the long-term value of the franchise, which you talked about, being properly weighed against short-term gains. But it's often the capital markets that are driving that short-term focus. So is there some role, and I don't know what the role is, but is there some... Do we need to also address that focus of the market to be able to make these longer changes?
Perhaps. I'm not sure where the short-term incentive, the incentive for short-termism in financial institutions come from. Some people say it's the management, and other people say it's the underlying investors in the equity. They're kind of demanding kind of good returns every quarter. I'm not sure where the balance there is. One other point's on the capital markets, though. I think at the moment, the capital markets can provide a kind of a safety valve if banks become kind of too tight in their credit supply, some firms can go to the capital markets. So it's a safety valve in a way, but only large firms can do that. So my particular concern at the moment is the supply of credit to small business. Many bankers tell me they're unsure about how the responsible lending laws apply to small business loans, and so they're taking, in some cases, a very conservative approach because the risk management people and the lawyers with inside financial institutions say, look, you know, do every piece of due diligence you can and then maybe do some more before you make the loan. So the supply of credit to small business, I think, has tightened up, and the capital markets are not a safety valve for that. They're a safety valve for large business, but not for small business. So I think we need to watch the supply of credit to small business very carefully.
There was a question here. Just there.
Hey, Governor, this is Anthony Ross from Chartered Accountants Australia New Zealand. You spoke about building buffers into the system. I'd really love to know about Australia's gold reserves. So when the RBA plans to do another audit on our gold reserves, and with 99.9% of our current gold reserves in the Bank of England, whether the RBA has a plan to bring any of them back to Australia?
No, we don't. We do regular audits of our gold reserves to make sure all there and accounted for, and I can report that every audit is, we get a clean bill of health there. We keep the gold reserves in London because that's where the centre of the gold lending market is. We, by able to kind of lend out our gold temporarily, we can earn a small incremental return on it and cover some of the costs of holding those reserves. So I think it's kind of the right place for the gold to be. We don't have any plans to sell any more, to buy any more, or to bring it back to Australia.
At the back? Yes, sorry, yep.
Governor, Michael Heath from Bloomberg News. The standard estimate, I guess, for full employment has been 5%, which we've now reached. And obviously the global experience is that countries are having to go much lower than their normal or traditional full employment or NIRU to get wage growth. We're sort of seeing it in the US. Do you have an estimate now for what the new level would be in Australia? Is it 4% now or 3.5% or 4.5%? Have you got that far?
No, I don't have a new estimate. I mean, the number of 5% was kind of a conventional estimate coming from various modelling approaches. I never had particular adherence to that as kind of being the true answer. It's interesting, in New South Wales at the moment, the unemployment rate is 4.4%. I think here in Victoria it's 4.6. And in both states, the rate of wage growth is kind of 2.3 or 2.4. So we're seeing in the two biggest states be able to sit with an unemployment rate around 4.5% and that not cause wages to accelerate. I suspect nationally we could sit around 4.5% without seeing wage growth pick up by too much. So I certainly hope that's the case, and we'll have to wait and see. But we're gradually inching down and testing how far we can go without wage growth accelerating too quickly. Our underlying strategy is to have the labour market tighten up to get wages to pick up. Inflation picks up closer to 2.5% and real wages increase as well. So that's our strategy, and I think we can go lower than 5%, and I certainly hope so.
Might just take one or two more questions. One at the front.
Governor, it's Michael Stanford, non-exec director on various company boards. It's a great topic, really well expressed. A long time ago, I was taught that trust is built from openness and spontaneity. Tonight, you were very open. I suspect it might be at times at 2 a.m. you'd love to push out a tweet with your personal Philip Lowe view. But you represent an organisation and a broader purpose, and everybody hangs off every word and the spaces between words. How do you balance your personal thoughts with the organisational thoughts and yet maintain trust?
Well, I don't have a Twitter account, so that's you can rest assured that I won't be sending out... most of the time, I don't have particular trouble balancing the organisational thoughts with my personal thoughts because by nature, if something comes into my mind, I'm inclined to say it. Curate around the edges, but I don't find that a kind of a particular difficulty. As a public official and an independent public official, I feel like I can speak my mind almost always, not in every case, but pretty much always. I try and steer clear of making overtly political comments, but I do try and make analytical comments on topics, even if they're not convenient for the government or the opposition at the time. So that's how I balance these things.
Staying with technology, I have a question coming through on the iPad where Alex asks, does the recent instability of federal leadership impact on any of the RBA strategies?
Well, the short answer to that is no. business confidence is high. Well, that's business are investing and they're employing people. I think that's the most important thing. You know, it's perhaps a sad thing to say, but many in the community have got used to the political turmoil in Canberra. when we had the first rotations of leadership a number of years ago, every business meeting I went to, that's all anyone wanted to talk about. Now they don't talk about it so much. Unfortunately, we've got used to it, and businesses are going on and investing and hiring people as they should be.
Last question. Perhaps I'll just end. Oh, there's one more. Sorry, there's one more there. Sorry.
Thank you. Rob Fowler from HESTA. Governor, you've talked about the linkage between the unemployment rate and the hope that the wages growth rate will increase as unemployment come down. What discussions has the RBA had about the effect of casualisation? Because we were talking about the table and the effect it's having on people's savings. I'm just wondering whether or not you have any observations as to how that linkage between the two may well be impacting the what would normally be a fairly strong linkage between lower unemployment and a growing wage rate.
I think it's probably had some role, but I wouldn't overstate it, because the best data that we can get says there's been an increase in casualisation, but it's a fairly small change. The vast bulk of people still have permanent jobs. Two-thirds of the labour force have full-time jobs, and a third have part-time jobs, and most of the people who are working part-time are happy with the hours they're working part-time. There has been some increase in casualisation, but I wouldn't overstate it. There are deeper things going on, and they're global in nature, because this concern about the lack of real wage growth is central to kind of almost every Western economy, which suggests there are global factors at work. That we often look for Australian-specific things, but I don't think that's the right place to be looking. And my take on it is it's a combination of globalisation and technology. Everyone feels like there's a bit more competition out there, and globalisation technology also make you more uncertain about the future. So if you feel like there's more competition and you're more uncertain, the result of that is you feel like you've got less pricing power. And businesses feel that, and workers feel like that as well. The example I'm fond of quoting at the moment is a professional services firm in Sydney has outsourced the PAs to some of their senior executives to a facility in Manila. And they're able to do, and they say, well, this is just as efficient rather than having the PA sit next door to you. To have an app on your computer, you tap on the app and your PA can appear there in Manila, and you can talk to your PA and pass instructions and information, and that's just as efficient. The result of that is there's less upward pressure on the wages of PAs in Sydney. In the first wave of kind of globalisation, it was manufacturing workers that felt the pressure. But now, because of technology and globalisation, white-collar workers in Sydney and Melbourne feel that same pressure that manufacturing workers in the US felt with the liberalisation of the trade market. So white-collar workers everywhere, right around the world, feel like there's more competition for their job because of technology and globalisation, and they also feel a bit more uncertain about the future because of all this kind of innovation and structural change going on. I think that's at the heart of the issue, the kind of the uncertainty and the perceptions of greater competition. And these other issues about casualisation playing some role, but it's not the main story. As I said before, our strategy at the Reserve Bank is to keep interest rates low, have the labour market tighten up so that people will get over these concerns about competition, firms will get over it, workers will get over it, and we'll see an increase in income growth for the household sector, which will be good for consumption, be good for people paying back debts, and I think it would be good for political discourse as well.
Last question, which you can have a one-word answer to. Whenever we have these evenings, we always talk about housing affordability. 2 years ago, we were talking about increasing prices. Tonight, we were talking about decreasing prices. When we are back here in 2 years' time, would you care to forecast what... I have to work out whether I've got to buy something.
Give forecasts. Can I choose option C? I hope that'd be stable.
Yeah. Good.
Because as I showed in my graph that the prices in Sydney and Melbourne got extraordinarily high, and 18 months ago, the biggest political issue in the country was housing affordability. people were saying, how can my kids ever afford housing? You know, people were mortgage stressed. It was the biggest political issue in the country. The budget last year was framed around improving housing affordability. 18 months on, prices have come down, and certain sections of the community think this is kind of a disaster. But it does mean housing is more affordable. More young families and more individuals can get into housing, which is a good thing. And if we continued on the previous track, we were going to end up with big problems. The adjustment we're having is manageable. The IMF, you might have noticed today, put out a statement after its long mission to Australia, and they said the cooling of the housing market is welcome and it can be weathered in a strong economy like we have in Australia. The correction's orderly, and I expect it will stay that way. There are downside risks, but the background in which this adjustment is occurring is a fairly benign one. Low unemployment, unemployment declining, interest rates are low, they're likely to stay low. The economy is doing well, businesses are investing and hiring people, and population's growing strongly, and we don't have oversupply in the market, except for in some very small locations. So the general background in which we're having this adjustment, I think, is a positive one, and I think it's entirely manageable.